I have 60 slides, so I need the full time.
Okay, let us start now. Welcome to another great semester of robotics seminars. This semester will have two co-chairs, me and Paul Ripsky, and the idea is that that way we'll get a little bit more of a balanced thing, some graphics, some vision, some robotics, some random stuff, and we'll have some random stuff in the pipeline. And we are very, very happy to open the seminar with our local Ralph Hollis, who has been graciously agreed to give a lecture, which sounds like it would be really fun because it has Maglevin title. Just a little bit about Ralph. He told me to be brief. So Ralph is well known in NCMU, but maybe not everybody knows that he had got his PhD in solid state physics, and then he worked at places like North American Aviation, and even went to Paris at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique as an exchange scientist for a year. Then he went to IBM, where he won a lot of awards and inventions. Since he got to Michel, you missed my French. Ralph has won the Nakamura Prize at IROS 01 and 95, and the Best Video Award at ICRA 99, and he was the finalist for the Christopher Columbus Fellowship Foundation Discover Award in 2000. And he is the director of the Microdynamic Systems Laboratory. And without further ado,
thank you, Aloshi. Let's maybe turn the lights down just a little bit if you can. So thanks for everyone to come. I'm going to talk about haptics. I'm going to explain what that is. I'm going to talk about Lorentz magnetic levitation. I'll try to explain what that is. But this talk is really a personal journey that spans a long, long time. It's a long journey. It's been interesting, and we've learned a lot along the way. So hopefully I can impart some anecdotes at least from that. Let's see now, I got to get this working. There we go. So haptics is this science of touch. Haptics comes from the Greek root haptikos, meaning able to grasp or perceive. And when you think about haptics in computers, we have text, we have graphics, we have speech, and so forth. But until recently, we didn't really have any decent sense of touch. In fact, we still don't really have a decent way to interact through the sense of touch. And yet, we have so many analogies with touch in our everyday speech. For example, like we say something like, get a feel for the problem, or stay in touch, or hands-on learning, or pressing issues, or a touchy subject, at my fingertips, pushy behavior, and in the case of my talk, a hard-hitting presentation. So people have been fascinated by touch and the human hand for so many years, and a lot of people have studied it. These are some structures of the hand here. Basically, in the hand there are some 100,000 nerves, at least 20 different kinds. 12 of those kinds receive touch sensations. There are only 8 motor fibers coming from the spine to the hand. And there are about 3,000 touch receptors in every finger. Well, that's quite a few. Each hand has more receptors than the entire trunk of the body. So when we think about touch, we kind of naturally gravitate to talking about the hand. So I'm going to be concerned with the hand mostly in this talk. But of course, we have touch everywhere. So in the hand, there are really two kinds of mechanisms that we're concerned with. There are the skin sensors that, for example, are receptive to touch, pressure, vibration, that sort of thing. And then there's proprioception, sensors that are located in our muscles and joints and tendons that can respond to joint angle, length of muscle, rate of change of length of muscle, for example, or tendon tension. So those are the proprioceptive senses. It's interesting that people have studied, if you do a pressure pattern on the skin of the finger, like, for example, an embossed letter A, for example, that letter A travels to the brain still spatially in the brain as a letter A. The fibers don't mix up or anything. It actually gets imaged in the brain, in the cortex, as an A. I don't know how they figured that out, but it's an interesting observation, interesting fact. So if we looked at the kinesthetic senses, one type of sense we have is the muscle spindle that can sense tension along the muscle. And it's actually pretty cool because it's a servo mechanism. It not only can act as a sensor, but it actually has muscle fiber. And it can, as the muscle strengthens, something that just sensed tension would get out of its range. So it applies a little force to get back in a linear range. And there's a little local servo loop running there with the muscle spindles. One of the earliest studies was the Golgi tendon organ located here. So it's a little thing at the end of a tendon, and you see the wiring comes in here, goes through some kind of process, the muscle pulls, and it can sense the tension. So that's pretty cool. So along with this kinesthetic or proprioceptive sense of touch, we have a whole technology of touch that has arisen in the last, I'd say, 15 years mainly, and that is haptic feedback devices. So there's the famous Phantom device out of MIT, which provides 3 degrees of freedom. The user moves the end around here and can interact with an object, like touch a point on the object and feel forces back in the hand. People have developed 4 degree of freedom devices. Here's another 3 degree of freedom device. This is a 5 degree of freedom device here, University of Colorado. 6 degree of freedom device, another one here. A whole arm device, and so forth. All of these kinds of devices provide kinesthetic or proprioceptive feedback to the hand or the arm. As such, they have lots of motors and gears and tendons and wires and so forth, and they, generally speaking, are a fairly low frequency kind of thing. So they don't really interact very well with the skin. They mainly interact with the kinesthetic senses that I just talked about. So in addition to the kinesthetic or proprioceptive senses, we have the skin itself. So there are these four main groupings here. The Pacinian corpuscles, for example, located down here, they're actually pretty big. They're like a fraction of a millimeter long. This is a CAD model of one of those things that somebody developed. They're actually very sensitive to vibration. The Meissners are activated when there's very light touch on the skin, for example. Stretching of skin tends to excite these guys here, and pressure can sense the Merkel's disc can sense pressure. Now, these type here, RA, are a rapidly adapting type, so they're really AC kind of sensors, whereas the SA, slowly adapting, can kind of measure a DC force or sensation like that. So as well as the science of touch, which has been studied in great detail, there's a technology going along with that too. This just gives an idea of some of the frequency responses. You can see the Pacinian corpuscles actually lower means it's more sensitive. Has a peak response of around 250 hertz. So if you run your finger across the table and you feel that vibration, about 250 hertz is the optimum for the Pacinians. So as I mentioned, the technology of touch, people have tried to provide this skin activation by a number of different means. So This little thing here uses shape memory alloys. You can put your finger in there, and it moves and it stretches the skin laterally. And of course, under computer control, so you get the sensation that you're touching something. There are different mice that can vibrate, vibrating fingertips, little loudspeakers on the fingertips, vibrating motor belts around the waist. Some work has been done in rolling contact, so that this little roller is rolling along the finger, and they can simulate like rolling your finger over an edge, and it feels pretty good. These all interact with those skin sensors that I mentioned. So where's all this going? Well, there's really been a tremendous explosion of interest in haptics. And these are a number of papers with the word haptics that are going up, and we don't have data yet for 2006 quite, but I'm sure it'll be up here somewhere. And in 2008, there will be a new IEEE journal, Transactions on Haptics, to go along with the Transactions on Robotics and Transactions on Automation Science and Engineering. So it's getting to be a really big thing. A lot of people are interested in it. The World Haptics Conference last year had 500 people or something in Japan. It was pretty good. There's a lot of different conferences starting up too. Okay, so sort of noodling around with this for a long time, came up with some observations. We want to provide a high fidelity experience. We don't want anything to get in the way of, say, a virtual computed environment and your hand, ideally. So we want to minimize all the machinery that goes between the person and the environment. We have a notion of haptic transparency, which many people have talked about, sort of like a window being transparent. If it's clean and everything, you can see right through it. If the haptic device is transparent, you can feel right through it, so to speak. So these haptic force feedback devices out there primarily engage the kinesthetic senses. I mentioned the frequency response is low. There's some limitations on resolution, stiffness, and so forth. And on the other hand, the haptic vibrotactile feedback devices primarily engage the skin sensors, but they're often just buzzing or some other simple sensation. It's difficult to impart that sensation over the whole hand without having a lot of those kind of actuators and arrays of them. And there's no way to experience forces and torque unless perhaps these two are combined some way. So we think we're on to a reasonable way to somewhat combine these two modalities in one single system. So we've taken a different approach. And at this point, I want to dial back the clock 23 years ago. And this is a sketch I made one evening sitting on my living room couch. Suddenly I kind of had a revelation. I was working in robotic fine positioning devices at IBM Research in Yorktown Heights. And I came to some realization. I made these sketches in 83, 84 here, which show some coils and some magnets and so forth. Just at that point, neodymium iron borons had become possible. You could actually order them. Before that, it was sort of talk of very high magnetic strength materials, but suddenly these were available. There was also high-speed digital signal processors. So, for example, I ran out and bought a $9,000 one, which could make the computations possible that I wanted to do. And I happen to have already a knowledge of non-contact position sensing. What we did is we designed a robot wrist that used magnetic levitation to float in space. And we sort of developed this principle that I've started to call years ago Lorentz levitation, because it's based on Lorentz forces. So I'm going to briefly go through how this works. So we have a permanent magnet that generates a magnetic field of some sort. We have a wire coil in that magnetic field. This is a computer, so we can control the current rapidly through this. There's a little element of wire, and interacting with the element of current provides a little force DF like that. So if we have a rigid body And we have at least six of these these actuators like this attached to that body, whereas the other part of the actuator is fixed. But there's some space where this mass can move around. And this is a non-degenerate kind of geometric configuration. And we observe the position and orientation of the body. We can create a feedback loop here to stably levitate and move this body. So that's the basic principle. This is our first device, which was built in 1987. And I remember we worked like hell with my colleague Tim Salkudian to get this working, because we had a paper we submitted to the International Symposium for Robotics Research, which is one of the first ones, I don't know, 20 years ago. So I had to give the paper even before it worked. But I thought it was really cool, and I gave the paper and all that. And there was a competition for Best Paper Award, so I was thinking, yeah, best paper, you know, going to get the best paper. Well, I didn't get the best paper. But one well-known roboticist humorously noted that it probably should be voted as the technology least likely to succeed. So, anyway, about a month after that, we got the thing flying in the lab, so we could turn it on, the thing would lift off like it's shown here, it's floating, we can move it around in 6 degrees of freedom, with the computer signal processor cranking away, and it was hooked to a even before a PC, I don't even know what it was. Some kind, I guess it was a PC, but it was, you know, the best PC we could get, which is like a 4 megahertz processor and so on. So we were really excited. We thought, okay, we're going to get the big manager in to see it, because we felt this could be really key stuff. So this was a guy, he was in charge of a whole department of 150 people, so you know, it took like 2 months to schedule this and everything, but he showed up on time, and Tim was getting nervous, and he said, you know, I think I ought to reboot the computer because something bad's going to happen. So he rebooted the computer, fired up everything. The guy walked in, you know, with his suit and tie. And, okay, give the demo. Tim typed some stuff. Nothing happened. It didn't take off. And he's looking, and the manager is looking closer and closer. It's sitting on the table. He gets down by like this. All of a sudden, smoke comes right up his face. So he said, that's interesting. Turned around, walked out, and he never ever saw it again. So it turned out the D to A converters we had, they initialized to maximum current instead of zero current. Not good. And so it was maximum downward force, so it was going straight down into the table. Anyway, so we learned a lesson not to reboot, never reboot, never change it. So anyway. So a little later on, we came across this 75-page paper, which was a comprehensive survey of every known technology for magnetic levitation. And I'm not going to go through these. There's a lot of different methods and so forth. I've studied all of these. And it turns out that our method is not one of those. It's really a tenth method. And we wrote Jay Awant about it and everything, and he looked at it, and he agreed that we had invented a new thing. So we called it Lorentz levitation. People often confuse it with magnetic bearings. Magnetic bearings use the Maxwell force, which is different. This does not. Magnetic bearings don't use the Lorentz force. And so it's a qualitatively different way of levitating something. So we do believe we're the first to levitate and control a rigid body using this technique, anyway. So based on that and some funding that I somehow managed to get, we designed the what we called the IBM Magic Wrist, and the idea was to put this on the end of a robot arm, like this, so the robot could move around, and then this could be levitated and move very fine motion. So you can see it on the robot here, and here it is, right here. So this shows how it works. Whoops, I should not do that. So in position control, we're moving in X, Y, and rotation and so forth. over a range of 5 millimeters, something like that. And also we could synthesize various compliances. So for example, a slider in the X direction where it's stiff in other directions, we can make a Y-axis slider, for example, make an XY slider, and so forth. So the idea was we could put this mechanism at the end of a robot arm, and what people used in automated assembly, they used certain compliances that you designed and built in the machine shop to do things, to insert cards in slots, to insert pegs in holes, and so forth. We didn't need to do that because we could do it all in software. So right here we're showing emulation of a remote center compliance device. So it's actually rotating about this point while translating as well, and so forth. And we realized we could do all these things. We could emulate mechanism, we could sense forces, we could do guarded motion, self-corrected repetitive assembly, vibration, everything. So that was cool. One of the things we did was we interfaced it with a scanning tunneling microscope here. We use this as the haptic master in a way. This is some sputtered gold. This is the scanning tunneling microscope. And as the operator's hand is moved back and forth a distance of 6 millimeters here, the hand is moving up and down a few millimeters. But the actual distance on the sample, this bar here, you can't see it, but it's 2 nanometers. And the distance down here is 10 nanometers. So we're able to reduce the hand motion by a factor of about 10 to the sixth to control the tip of the scanning tunneling microscope while increasing the force from the tunneling microscope by a factor of about 10 to the eighth. So this was the first case of being able to, in real time, feel atomic scale features on a sample with the human hand. So this has been taken up by many people. People generally use AFMs now, and a huge amount of work has been done on this. There's a lot of products and so forth out there. Oops, wrong. We also realized that this technology could be really good for vibration isolation. That's kind of illustrated here. If we have a platform that's vibrating here, sine omega t here, this is a levitated mass that has a spring and a damper, because that forms if it has a PID control operating, for example, it's basically a spring and a mass. If we have an algorithm that gradually increases the feed forward forces that are not position dependent, and gradually reduces the P and D terms of the PID controller so that the springs gradually go away, we eventually wind up with this sort of thing where the mass is still being levitated and the mass is being more or less exactly balanced by the magnetic force. When that happens, there's essentially no connection between the vibrating base and the mass. As a demonstration, we did this on the magic wrist, and it was a pretty cool demo. It had a little down feather from a goose that was like that big, and didn't weigh very much, but I could just drop it and it would float down, and when it touched the wrist, it would drop down. So it could weigh a down feather by this technique, for example. So the reason that can work is rather complicated, but this is a diagram of a Lorentz actuator where we have a large magnet surface and a small coil. So as this coil moves, the force is really independent of position to a very large extent. And by careful engineering, you can make it almost perfectly independent of position over some limited motion range. So we can also attach the mass virtually to a pseudo-inertial body if we have some other sensor that we believe is inertia, an inertial sensor, an inertial body. We can do that. We can also, use it in space where we can point a sensitive payload somewhere, like at a star or some feature, and then gradually reduce the fields until this is just sitting there. And then the astronauts are jumping around and bouncing around in the shuttle of the space station. That does not get transferred across the magnetic gap, so the thing can still point. Now, there's drifts because of solar wind, gravity gradient, and so forth. Those can be compensated for by putting very gradual currents in the actuators to maintain the pointing direction. So I spent a couple of years trying to sell this to NASA. Went to 6 NASA centers. They all said, no, forget it. However, my friend Tim managed to work with the Canadian Space Agency and the astronaut, the Icelandic astronaut, Bjarni Tryggvason, actually developed this micro-isolation mount number 1 here in Canada, and it flew on Mir for 3 years before it crashed in the atmosphere and burned up. And after that, Bjarni, let's hear what he has to say.
And based on those results, we actually adjusted, if you talk about this one a little bit, to improve on that. And in the data that I sent to the ground from this unit, the folks on the ground report back up that we've got about a 4 to 5 improvement in the performance of this system. And that's largely because of the small changes we've made to the design of the system. Now, this has been probably reasonably wild. We've been surprised by a couple of things that we're dealing with. And we have one maintenance issue that we've solved, I think, now, and we're in operation here again. But it is performing quite well. I think they certainly improve the vibration environment for experiments, the type that we're going to do in the next few years on the space station.
So I know Bjarni. He's quite a guy. And so it flew on STS-85 in 1997. And it was isolating some physics experiments dealing with liquid mixing. So along about that time, Tim and I started to realize that this magnetic levitation could actually be used for haptics. We sort of saw that in the case of exploring the atomic scale landscape. But we managed to interface one of the magic wrists to a computer so we could control a block running around and hitting things. In 1994-95, I got PhD student Peter Berkelman, and he was able to program a virtual environment and make this work so that we could feel forces and torques by manipulating a 3D object in a virtual environment. So things looked pretty promising at that point. Meanwhile, at British Columbia, Tim had developed a number of micro wrists for surgical purposes. Also developed a small desktop, inexpensive haptic device that used magnetic levitation. Here's some details of it. He was trying to commercialize this. Unfortunately, it didn't quite go, so it's not really available at a very small motion range. Anyway, Peter and I designed a new system right here for haptic interaction, and that system's been operating continuously since 1998, and literally hundreds of subjects, people have used it without breaking it, amazingly. Zach Butler was another student also working with us. So the way it looks, it has what we call a floater, in analogy with a rotor of a motor. The floater has 6 flat coils, they're actually spherical, and it's attached to a handle like that. It's sitting in these permanent magnets, 24 permanent magnets that are making a very strong field through those coils. And then attached to this floater are 3 light-emitting diodes, which are imaged in 3 optical position sensors based on lateral effect position sensing diodes. So that's how it works. And then the whole thing goes in a case. And that's what you see right here. So this is a little video of Peter talking back in 1998.
In the Microdynamic Systems Lab at the Robotics Institute of Carnegie Mellon University, we have developed a new haptic interface device based on magnetic levitation. The device and all amplifiers, processing, and power supplies are contained in a single desktop height cabinet. The range of motion of the floated handle is 25 millimeters in translation and 15 to 20 degrees in rotation. Its maximum stiffness is 25 newtons per millimeter at a 1000 hertz servo control rate. Motion can be allowed or constrained in any direction.
So you get the idea. So I'm going to run pretty quickly through this, but there's some kinematics involved. Each one of these coils produces a force given by the current in the coil and the local magnetic field. Then there's torques generated by combinations of these coils. And the total force torque vector, the six component vector, is related to the six components of current by this linear actuator matrix here to first approximation. So we can use just a PID controller to make it float and move its position and orientation. The way we sense the position is through position sensing diodes. I'm sure many of you know about these. But we use lenses here. So as the floater moves around, the LED moves around and it images on the sensor. And we have three of these on the device. And the actual sensor is a two-dimensional sensor. So the spot moves around here and generates photocurrents and the Y1 and Y2 and X1 and X2. And by these simple calculations here, we can figure out the position of the light spot and hence the position of the LED on the floater. However, these devices are highly nonlinear, so they have this barrel distortion. So we do a mapping to make it into a rectangular grid like that. So that's how we measure the floater position and orientation. We get these unit vectors to the light spot on each sensor, and we can then figure out the change in the frame from the initial position to the final position. And if we look at the inverse kinematics, that is, if we know the position and orientation of the floater, can we figure out where the light spots are? Turns out it's really easy. It's just these simple calculations here. So, for example, this is the position of the light spot on sensor A, the X position and the Y position, just these simple trigonometric conditions. However, the forward kinematics, which is what you really need, because we measure the position of the light spots, and from that we somehow have to figure out the position and orientation of the floater. That's really hard, and there's no closed-form solution. So one of my students, Stella Yu, managed to boil the problem down into the solution of three coupled simultaneous quadratic equations. And that is solved by a Newton-Raphson method followed by successive LU decomposition cycles. So in about two or three iterations, we can get the position of the floater down to, and orientation down to submicron kind of numbers. So that's how we do it. Here are some characteristics. The motion range, we can produce quite high stiffness, 25 newtons per millimeter. The commercial Phantom device has about 0.6 newtons per millimeter, for example. Makes it very hard to emulate a hard surface. An interesting thing is that the power to levitate is only about 2.5 watts. So it can sit there all day, even with your hand on it, the mass of your hand, and it doesn't get very warm. It has a frequency response up here of about 125 hertz, I think. Well, greater than 100. It's about 125 hertz. And because of that, and the high motion resolution, which is about 5 to 10 microns, we can produce a very high fidelity experience for the user. So one way to look at it is like this, where we plot frequency here and in hertz and displacement in microns here. And a typical back-driven robot arm type device would have a frequency response up in here. It depends on how many degrees of freedom and many other things. And has a rather poor resolution, around 100 microns, let's say. So the haptic space that's accessible by those kinds of devices limited to what's in this rectangle, more or less. Now, if you look at these fuzzy things, these are taken sort of liberally from various papers. These are kind of the range of activation for these four kinds of skin sensors. So we're sitting up here over 100 hertz. So we have all of this space accessible to us. So not only do we get proprioceptive feedback to the hand, but to a significant extent, I think, we can activate the skin sensors. We can do vibration, which activates those. So in this sense, we sort of are somewhat combining some of the features of a tactile array with a kinesthetic device. Here's Peter talking again about using it.
The magnetic levitation haptic interface device can be used with a workstation as a combined haptic and graphic interface for simulated environments. Simple simulations can execute on the local control processor using the workstation for display only. In this simulation, the user feels corner, edge, and face contact between the inner cube and the outer wireframe cube. The 75 Hz small motion bandwidth and the 5 to 10 micron position resolution of the device are sufficiently high that realistic surface effects can be emulated. Here, each quadrant of the displayed surface has a different friction and texture. Impact dynamics are also simulated. More complex dynamic simulations execute independently on a workstation and exchange tool position set points with the local controller through an Ethernet network. The simulated tool and the actual haptic interface device position and orientation are coupled by stiffness and damping gains. Objects in this simulation are manipulated with a paddle-shaped tool. The user can strike, push, pick up, or throw and catch objects in the simulated environment and feel the computer dynamic response of the tool. The simulation models physical dynamics, performs collision detection, and evaluates motion constraints on all the objects in the virtual environment in real time at an update rate near the position bandwidth of the haptic interface device.
So since around 2000, we've been doing psychophysical studies to try to understand how good this really is and try to understand more about how humans perceive forces and textures and so forth. So we've done a number of studies, a comparison of 3D peg and Hall tests in real and virtual, texture synthesis, and more recently in deformable objects. I'm going to run through some of these here. These are some background I'm not going to go in, but previous work that's been done on characterizing haptic response in terms of engineering parameters, and other people who have done a characterization of haptic interaction in terms of psychophysical analysis. So completion criteria, time analysis. Hannaford, for example, has done continuous force torque recording, and so on and so forth. Most of these are in very low dimensions, one-dimensional devices, two-dimensional devices, three, almost none in six-degree of freedom devices such as ours. So in one set of studies here with Bert Unger, here's the user. We're putting peg and Hall like this, so this is what the user sees. This is a picture of Bobby Klatsky, who's a psychology professor here at CMU, we've been working with for the past 6 years. So the user sees this kind of thing and tries to put the peg in the hole and can feel the response, basically. And we can change the peg clearance and dimensions and everything on the fly. So in the virtual case, this is inside our system. These are wires that feed to the LEDs and the coils in the floater. And that's what happens in the virtual case. We're putting a virtual peg in a virtual hole. But we came up with a trick of putting a real peg at the bottom and having it go in a real hole. So in one case, we could have a subject do a virtual case. In another case, we could have a real case. And the subject, a priori, they didn't know which was which. And some subjects actually thought the virtual one was a real one and vice versa, which was kind of interesting. So we got some interesting results. We found out that the success rate in the case of the real peg was better than the virtual peg. So the virtual is not as good as the real, is what these things are saying. It takes longer to put the virtual peg in the virtual hall. We don't quite understand that. We want to do more work in that area. We've done experiments with, for example, a virtual environment, a vision-only environment. We determined that just using vision is not as good as haptics. So these results are kind of in line with other people who have found that vision dominates over haptics, but vision, but haptics helps perception. So this is a recent work that Bert is doing with textures, and we can run over the textures with a sphere, and can vary the spacing of the textures, as well as the randomness of it. Virtually everything is variable. I don't know why this is stopping all the time. Maybe it's going. Oh, it's going over and over. Sorry. There we go. Here we go. So we're changing probe size, for example. So it's very small probe. And large probe, and as the subject does this, of course they feel different perceptions, and we can automatically take measurements of their ability to perceive and discriminate between different textures. So this is a case of spacing change. What Bert has found is that as the spacing gets larger and larger, we plot their roughness perception measurement versus the element spacing, it goes up like this, but it tends to saturate, and around this point when the sphere is sort of dropping into the texture, it crosses over at this point. And this pretty much mirrors experiments that are done with real textures and real probes. But in this case, again, because it's all in a virtual world, we can vary all the parameters. My student, Vinitra Varadharajan, developed a three-dimensional spring, you see here, which can be activated and moved up and down and moved around. Quite a complex model operating in real time to do psychophysical studies on how people perceive stiffness in spring. So a lot of things can be varied by the sliders, like the length of the spring, for example. How many turns the spring has. Let's see, what else? The diameter of the coil. And of course, as for example, the diameter gets bigger, the stiffness goes down automatically. And this is an analytical model based on work done in the 60s to analytically determine all the correct forces and torques and so on. We've gotten some preliminary results that look sort of like this. This is the just noticeable difference between different stiffnesses using vision and haptics together and just haptics alone. Again, vision helps in the discrimination between different spring stiffnesses. We get a little lower threshold of sensitivity. And as the stiffness of the spring, this gamma is basically a stiffness kind of value, although it says newtons here. But anyway. As it gets the spring gets stronger, the threshold goes up, which is what you'd expect. And if we take a curve along this, it should be kind of a straight line, the Weber fraction, so called. So we get a certain number. And these kinds of experiments have not been done, because to do them in real life would require actually fabricating a whole bunch of springs, without the subject knowing, switching one spring out and another spring and so forth. But here the computer program changes the springs in a subtle way during the subject's experiment. And we've run a few dozen subjects so far on this. Meanwhile, at University of British Columbia, Tim Salkudian has pursued teleoperation using this concept. They've developed a maglev wrist here. and a teleoperation system, so you move this master device and the slave device works. So we've done a similar thing here with the Puma robot, and this shows some capabilities, I guess, of moving the wrist itself, and we can move the Puma as well, Puma arm. For example, here's Jonathan pushing on here, Jonathan Hurst somewhere, there he is, and Bert down here. So if Bert moves something, this thing moves. If Jonathan hits it, this moves. So it's just like having six massless rods connecting between this device and this device, and all the friction and motor and dynamics and crap of the robot are out of the picture. So it's just magnetic levitation talking to magnetic levitation, and what's in between here is software and magic, sort of. Here's some other examples of trying to do some Lego assemblies and putting pegs in a hole and so forth. Here's putting a peg in a hole. So the slave magnetic levitation device and the master device can, of course, be many miles apart and operate. We've had a lot of interest recently from a couple of companies on possibly using this sort of thing to give people in the field very sensitive touch when they're trying to disarm IEDs in Iraq. So far, we haven't been funded, though, to do that. So these are some examples showing the master motion, moving, for example, in millimeters, and the slave motion here, and also the forces between the master and the slave, and you can see they track pretty well. So it's pretty transparent between the business end, the slave, and the master that you're operating with. Okay, so all that's kind of history. In the next few minutes, I'm going to kind of sum up here. So the question is, what's next? So 23 years have gone by. 23 years I've agonized about this. Millions of dollars have gone by since my original sketches. And if you count the flights in the mirror and the STS-85 shuttle mission, it's probably many tens or hundreds of millions of dollars that have gone into this crazy idea that was least likely to succeed, let's say. So I am told that the third version of this micro-isolation mount will someday be in the space station. Who knows if the space station will even get built. I guess they're making pretty good progress right now. Meanwhile, we have some pretty exciting projects underway right now, and I'm going to just briefly touch on those because we don't have any hard and fast results, but I'm going to tell you what we're doing. We've formed a magnetic levitation haptics consortium to try to spread this technology out. Because one of the complaints is, yeah, okay, it's great, but you have to come to your lab to use it. Like, why can't it be in my lab? Stuff like that. So we're taking steps to increase the availability of that as well as the application. We've actually re-engineered the system to be technically far superior to our original system in terms of motion range, bandwidth, resolution, and so forth. We put a whole lot of effort into making it more user-friendly. We've also dramatically reduced the cost of this system by a long way. And we've employed some interesting manufacturing technology as well to build this, like chemical machining, water jet cutting, carbon fiber molding, etc., spin forming, things like that. And we've built a batch of 10 of these new systems. These six of them are going to these to people in these universities here. Four will be staying back here at CMU. Three will be in my lab. So the idea is to get these into use, have graduate students using them for different experiments, research, and so forth, and get some more experience and so forth with them. So we've been encouraging this development, we want to start sharing the software and experience from these systems. This is what it looks like. It's a round thing, and it goes in a desk. This is a kind of cutaway view here. In this empty space, it's actually more stuff that isn't shown here. This is the shell of the floater, the handle, and it floats like that. Right now we have 2 of the 10 systems working in our lab, and we hope very soon to have the remaining 8 systems working. So one of the things we've started doing with the new systems is haptic interaction with running robots. There has been some work where people have used haptic interface devices to control mobile robots, wheeled mobile robots, robots that were fairly simple, didn't have much dynamics. The Rex robot, which is shown here, has a lot of dynamics, a lot of interesting action. It can go through all of these interesting territories and so forth. So it's normally controlled by a game controller, so the operator stands here pushing the buttons and can make it turn left and right and so forth. And there are algorithms, of course, in it that's causing it to run. So what we wanted to do is put a camera on board and control it haptically. So we're able to have our new device, and we can move the handle forward and backward. And when we do that, it'll start walking forward and it'll start running, or backwards. Or if we rotate the handle and yaw, it will turn around in place. And it just works like a dream, and we get video, real-time video back, and it works. And then recently, we have, with accelerometers and gyros that are on board the robot, we can feed back Z, X, roll, and pitch back to the hand. So the operator is actually experiencing what the robot is going through. And the idea is to create a greater situational awareness. So we don't know, maybe it hinders the operation of the robot, but it may turn out that it makes it easier to operate the robot remotely. We have to do the necessary experiments to really find that out. So that's a project is underway right now. We also have another project, which last year in our faculty retreat, we had a little competition among faculty to come up with a collaborative research project. 2 faculty had to join up that had never collaborated before. So George Stetton and I collaborated. It was really George's idea, not mine. And so anyway, we had a little competition, and we won. So we got a check for $10,000. So we started doing this, and it's a haptic micro-telemanipulation or telemicromanipulation, however you want to say it. This is Maximilian Heinig from Munich, who's sitting in the second row there, operating one of our working new devices, which is embedded in the tabletop. There's a control panel, and this is a microscope's view of what's at the slave end of this. And if we look at the slave end of it, looks like this. Max has been building all this up. We have one of our old 20-year-old magic wrists bolted to the table. And we can scale the motion down maybe by, we don't know for sure yet, but maybe by a factor of about 500. So a millimeter on the hand will be 2 microns on this device. And scale the forces up by about 500 as well, we think. And attached to this is a little needle. And that interacts with some biological specimens under the microscope. So we hope to be able to feel nuances in tissue. George's goal is to be able to take a single cell and poke the cell wall membrane and poke through and feel all that and go to the nucleus and feel the hard nucleus inside the cell. We're not there yet, but with George's guidance, we hope to get there. But this is just a little spider we happen to find in the lab. And a needle here. So this project is underway. We also, since we now have, we have 2, but we soon have 3 devices in our lab, we want to do 2-handed haptics. There's almost no situations out there in the world that have the facility to do 2-handed work. So for example, this is kind of fake. This is some graphics from Yerny Barbich, who just graduated in CS. PhD program, but you can imagine controlling the dinosaur in this hand and the Buddha in that hand, and fully 3-dimensional. Yerny has developed some of the very best algorithms for modeling the force and torque interactions between these two, and when you bang one against the other, we should be able to feel between our hands and then operate with both hands against a virtual environment that's fixed, for example. So There are a lot of applications like in microsurgery, fake dentistry, dental training, that sort of thing, we think. So we're just starting that project. So that's it. This is a list of some of the folks that have put their blood, sweat, and tears into this. That's my talk, and I'd be happy to answer questions. Dr. Mason.
Just an infinitely varied scaling of force and motion. I thought they would need to be coupled somehow.
Can we independently vary the force and motion? Microtele operation. Theoretically, yes. Practically, we're very, very close to being able to answer that question, but we're not. Really not quite there. There's control systems operating locally in both the master and slave, as well as another controller, effectively that's the combined system. And there is dynamics. There are issues, and you can compute only so fast. So I'd hesitate to say that for sure that it was independent, and we could just dial up this or that. So maybe one answer is that we're not actually transmitting forces between the master and slave, we're only transmitting position. And the reason that actually works is that there's no friction. So there's damping, but there's no static friction. So a very small motion of one device, we can measure that and send it to the other device and vice versa. I don't know if that makes sense or not. Yeah, Jonathan.
So how important is it to have appropriate receptive feedback to begin to move your arm around?
Yeah, so how important is it to be able to move your arm around? So I think there are a lot of applications. For example, Boeing has some applications of building an airplane where they're interested to know if an operator can reach in to a tight space and pull out a unit and put it back in. For that, obviously, absolutely you have to have a whole arm motion. We think there's a whole lot of applications, though, where a much more comfortable fingertip kind of motion will work great. It's much less tiring than using your whole arm. And there's actually been a trend in commercial haptic devices. There are now about 6 companies out there building haptic devices, selling them. There's been a trend over the past few years. The devices' workspaces are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. They're not as small as ours, but they're getting smaller and smaller so that they only involve really more or less wrist and finger motion. We think we can fit a certain niche, but certainly not cover the waterfront in terms of haptics.
So, one thing that's funny about the hand is that, you're showing us all this great stuff about how the sensors are all distributed around. They're like all over your fingers, and it's like a very large degree of freedom thing that these sensors are designed to work with. And then you've got this 6 degree of freedom thing, this kind of rigid body that you're interfacing it to.
Right.
And it seems like kind of a waste in a way that you're taking all these sensors and wrapping them around this one T.
Yeah.
And I guess you must have thought of like lots of different ways that you should do the interface. Should it be a ball, or should it be just one finger, or I don't even know what.
But. Right. I mean, well, to finesse that problem, we have interchangeable handles and so forth. But it is true that there's if you grab a sort of a handle, that's a fairly large area of skin that's in contact with the handle. So there is, and if it's able to move very quickly, you are exciting those sensors. Now, it's definitely not the same experience as moving your hand on something like that, but so many tasks in this world involve tool usage. It's actually interacting with a virtual environment by use of a tool. So if you have a And actually, if you have a sharp probe and move it over a texture, and you're holding that handle, you can perceive the texture, finer texture, using a tool like that than you can with the bare hand moving, where you have a very limited area of sensing moving over the thing. If you're able to sense over your entire skin surface, you can actually experience smaller textures. So another way to look at it is just it's tool-based haptics. Mostly, like let's say a surgical thing, okay, doctors have to touch things a lot too, but a lot of times they use tools as well, and this would be like working through a tool. I don't know. Yeah.
The range of motion is a little bit limited, and I wonder what are the limitations on how large you can move?
Yeah, the motion range is limited. It's about an inch and about plus or minus 8 degrees in rotation. A lot of people think that's really, really small. That's sort of dictated by physics. If we wanted to double that, we'd have to double the size of the thing. Or if we wanted to have it, we could have it. But we somehow picked that dimension for many different reasons.
The range of motion must have been tiny.
Pardon me?
For the mouse example that you showed that your colleague developed.
Yeah, that was 3 millimeters, which is really quite small. Some people like to move their mouse on their desk like this. Some people, like me, I like to move it over a very limited area because I'm really lazy. So this would appeal more to people that like to move over limited areas. And of course, we can scale up the motion. We can also use indexing where we can move from one point to another, like 30 feet, and then re-engage haptics. Or we can do rate control where moving the handle will cause a rate to happen in the virtual environment. Those are all kind of tricks that for increasing the workspace. Stanford published a method, the Stanford Drift method, that sort of slowly moves the center point of the haptic system as you're exploring an object, and psychophysically you feel like you have a larger haptic device. Every haptic device has a limited workspace. So it sort of depends. I mean, if you have a haptic device like this, but you're working on an elephant, it's small. If you're doing micro stuff, maybe ours is even large. So I don't know. Depends on what you're doing, I guess. I don't know. back there. Hello.
I'm curious, how small can you make it? Like, for doing the small manipulations and things, can you make it manipulate your haptics?
Well, so my colleague Tim Salkudian at UBC built one that's about inch and a half in diameter, kind of where it's a sort of a cylinder for micro surgery. It didn't work that well for some reason. I don't know why. I think you can make it even smaller. I'm even thinking of pencil eraser size for doing things with MEMS components.
All right, well, let's thank Ralph once again.